I'm Meenakshi, and as Shamnath said, I work at Finnegan. I've been there for 2 years now, and I practice both litigation and prosecution. And I'm basically in the area, in the software area. I do anything software related, any mention that's software related, internet and hardware, telecommunications, the whole gamut, as we all have to do. We can't stick to our area of specialization that much. Today I'm going to talk about recent trends in US patent law that affect global business practices relating to the acquisition and litigation of patents. And I will focus mainly on the software area because I heard that that was of interest to you. And at the end, I'll talk about Bilski. It's a case at the Supreme Court right now that my firm actually represented Bilski. So I know some inside knowledge, I guess, how much ever that may be. Okay, I'll start now. The first question I wanted to start off with is why identify trends at all? Trends in the case law, and why look to the future? And the answer to that is that it's really a fallacy to view patent prosecution and litigation as distinct and separate things that happen in patent law, despite the fact that they're separated by a lot of time. We usually view, the good view is to view, or the better view is to view the patenting process as a continuum with prosecution at one end, litigation at the other end, litigation or licensing at the other end. And so following trends in litigation allows patent prosecutors to draft claims that are likely to withstand litigation. They're likely to be stronger claims, but not too broad, broad claims that are not too broad. And you'll see what I mean later on in my talk. And this also helps litigators identify flaws in patents for arguing invalidity, for instance, or non-infringement. Oops, that wasn't what I tried to do. I'll give you a quick outline of my presentation. I'll give you a very quick basics of US patent law, just what you need to understand the rest of my talk. Then I'll talk about three trends in the law. And while talking on, about the trends in the case law, I'll obviously discuss some important cases and give you some practice pointers as non-US attorneys who, in the future, if you represent clients who want to acquire US patents, what you should look at, or if you're reviewing the work of a US patent attorney, what you should look at and the standards you should expect. Then in the end, we'll talk about business methods and software patents in the context of the Bilski case at the US Supreme Court. So these are the three trends I'm going to talk about today. Courts are nowadays affording varying levels of protection based on the claim type that is asserted. So depending on whether you assert a system claim or a method claim, often different parts of the patent law statute don't apply or apply with greater force. There have been significant changes in the standard for joint or divided infringement. The new standard is control or direction, and this is important for non-US lawyers to know about because a lot of times when you acquire a patent in any country, your infringers could be spread around the globe. So especially in the software, internet-based businesses or any kind of telecommunications business. And the third trend I'll talk about is that overly broad claims are nowadays being struck down by US courts very often for being invalid. So this is definitely a new trend, and earlier the thinking was get the broadest patent possible through the patent office and you're set, and now courts have smartened up and are striking down a lot of patents as invalid. So very quickly, not to bore you, but just to give you a very quick overview of some of the different sections I'll be referring to in the talks so that you're not lost. 35 U.S.C. 271A is the basic infringement section, and it just shows you what the different kinds of activities would make one liable for infringement. Whoever makes, uses, offers to sell, or sells in the U.S. or imports into the U.S. any patented invention. It's pretty general, pretty basic. And you'll find, I'm sure, just similar sections in Indian patent law. that you recognize. 271G is called the product by process section. It imposes liability for the unauthorized importation, sale, or use inside the country, inside the US, of a product made by a patented process or method. So if you have a US patent on a method or process, which is the same thing, and you use that abroad, that is not infringement. But then if you make a product using that process abroad, and then you import it into the country, then that becomes that. Then you can be liable under 271G. So this fixed a loophole in the previous patent law. This is another loophole that was fixed in 271F. It's called assembly abroad, and it imposes liability for supplying a substantial portion of the components of a patented invention, or a component especially made or especially adapted for use in the patented invention. So if it gets around the loophole that previously an infringing party could send out the different components of a product a product that would infringe, but send it abroad, assemble it abroad, and then import it, and that used to be not infringing, but now under 271F, assembling a patented product abroad by supplying the components from the country is infringement. Then it's 287A is just patent marking. It says that a patentee that fails to properly mark any patented article is not entitled to damages for infringement prior to actual notice. So this is very, very basic. If you don't mark your patented product, then you can't claim damages from before you actually send a letter to the infringing party saying, you're infringing. Is that difficult to hear? So I just introduced this because these are all going to be relevant in my talk. And you can lose for 287A, you can, if you don't mark your product properly, you can lose up to 6 years of damages that you could have gotten earlier otherwise, because, otherwise you can sue from the time of infringement rather than the time of actual notice. This is the last of the basic law. It's section 112, paragraphs 1 and 2. And this is about enablement and written description, and every patent law, I guess, in every system has something like this. The enablement requirement for a claim is satisfied when one skilled in the art, after reading the specification, can practice the claimed inventions without undue experimentation. That just means, have you taught your audience, which is the public, how to actually practice your invention? Have you revealed everything that was important to reveal so that they can, knowing what they know, can practice your invention? They don't have to go and invent something on their own in order to practice your invention. And then the written description test is a definiteness test, which asks whether those skilled in the art would understand what is claimed when the claim is read in light of the specification. Have you revealed this is just to explain to others in the public that a sense of what is and what is not your invention. So have you given a sense of the breadth of your claims? So is the breadth of your claim determinable? So this is the first trend I'll be talking about, that the varying levels of protection that are being afforded based on the claim type that is being asserted during litigation. So there are various claim types that are available. So I made this talk a little bit general because there are people who are not into patent law who would come here. So I'm just going to explain the basics. There are apparatus claims, system claims, method claims. These other two are very esoteric. So anyway, computer readable medium claims, which are more important these days. And there are significant differences between the claim types that you can assert. For instance, depending on the claim type you assert, the scope of your infringing activity could be broadened or narrowed based on geographical scope, for instance, getting extraterritorial infringers within your scope. It would determine who your infringers are and whether you can claim joint infringement or not, for instance, and damages also, how much, whether you can claim damages or not, depending on which claim you're asserting under what circumstances. And all this will become more clear as I go into the specific examples. So for instance, patent marking, that was 287A that we talked about a minute ago, basically says that the failure to properly mark a claimed apparatus or system claim can can preclude the patentee from recovering pre-suit damages up to 6 years. So if you fail to mark your product, you can lose a significant amount of damages. You have to actually give notice, and then you can start claiming damages from the time of notice. However, this statute doesn't apply to method claims. So, you know, so this is a good thing, I guess, for method claims, because there is no need to mark. So you can have a method claim. I guess you can't really, the thinking was that you really cannot mark a method. So it doesn't really make sense to have 287A apply to method claims. So the takeaway idea is always have some method claims in your invention, in your set of claims. The assembly abroad provision 271F that we just talked about also applies to cases where the patented invention is assembled outside of the US. So this gives US patents some extraterritorial scope. And even this does not apply to methods or processes. This was decided by a Federal Circuit case recently, 2009. And this is pretty important because, you know, this is bad for methods or processes, because then, you know, you lose out on extraterritorial scope. So, you know, it's good to have methods, but it's also good to have other claim types, existence, etc. Now I'll talk about extraterritorial scope in this context of this first trend, which is the varying scopes. In today's world, it is not uncommon for commercial systems and methods to be implemented or provided across national borders. As I mentioned, you have e-commerce systems, any kind of network solution, any telecom system often has a component that is in a different country. So for your infringers. So some claim types are more advantageous than others in seeking to cover such activities. So when you're drafting your claim, if you think of who your infringer is going to be, you need to keep in mind that they could be outside the country. So you need to think about what claim types to include, systems or methods. And so that's the thinking that should be going along with claim drafting. A patent with limited claim types can result in limited or no damages, as we will see. So the question, big question in extraterritorial infringement is, can infringement exist when part of a system or method is practiced or used outside of the US? So this was a issue in NTP v. Research in Motion. This is a very famous case from 2005 that I thought to include because it was right on point, and it was heavily in the press. So if you follow US law at all, you might have heard of it. So the background of the case is that NTP, which is really a non-practicing entity or a troll, sued Research in Motion for patent infringement over the use of RIM's BlackBerry system. And NTP then alleged that the use of the BlackBerry phone infringed both the system, both its systems and method claims. So it had a set of system claims and method claims in its patents, and it asserted both types of claims. And the main issue was whether under 35 U.S.C. 271A, that is the basic infringement section, infringement could be found notwithstanding the fact that one of the main components, the relay, was in Canada and not inside the country. So again, I've just listed 271A for your benefit, just to remind you of, you know, the users part here. That was invoked by the courts. So the holding in this case was that there was direct infringement of the system claims, of NTP's system claims, even though part of this system, which is a very important part, the relay, was in Canada. So the way the system worked, a very high-level view of the way the BlackBerry system worked, as probably all of you know, is that the mail comes into the mail server of wherever you get your mail from, Gmail or wherever. The mail is routed from there to a relay, a BlackBerry-owned relay, which is then, and then the mail is sort of encrypted and copied or whatever, and it's routed from there to through the wireless network to your handheld. So, and when you write an email from your BlackBerry, it goes through the wireless network to the relay and then back to the mail server, etc. So the relay is very central. The basic point is the relay is very central. So the court said that the use of a claimed system is the place at which the system as a whole is put into service, i.e. the place where control of the system is exercised and beneficial use of the system is obtained. So they focused on, you know, using the system as a whole, not particular parts of the system, like not particular components. And so that made the fact that the relay was in Canada less important. And they also focused on the fact that, you know, looked at who was controlling the system and who benefited from the system. And they decided that the system was controlled by the BlackBerry users, and beneficial use was also obtained by the BlackBerry users. So they controlled the system by actually sending and receiving emails, and they received beneficial use by, you know, the fact that they got and received emails, they benefited from it. So the holding was that the system claims were infringed. And this was the popular part of the holding, which was in the press, and BlackBerry was almost shut ahead.
I didn't understand how control was exercised by the BlackBerry users.
Oh, it's because they sent the emails.
So the relay system would be programmed by BlackBerry's technicians.
Yeah, I mean, answer to that is the courts are not that right when it comes to technology, as you see in a lot of other cases.
Okay.
They sort of get the technology wrong, and they're very, I guess, they're not immune from lawyers making arguments that are technically not sound.
But I guess they would be having experts to testify before.
Yeah, but then you have experts on both sides, and whichever expert they can understand better, they go with. So it's not, the courts are really not the bastions of technology. So anyway, they thought that control was off the system meant by sending or receiving an email. That was their reasoning, I guess. A lot of these holdings are not very technologically sound. Then this part of the holding actually was not in the press as much because it didn't cause BlackBerry to have to almost shut down their system, etc. So, but this was more discussed in the patent community. And it was the fact that there was no infringement of the method claims that were asserted. The court said that the use of a patented method is different from use of a patented system. And a process cannot be used, or a method cannot be used within the United States as required by 271A unless each and every step is performed within the country. So here they looked at each step, not the method as a whole. So several of the steps in the method claims were performed by the relay in Canada. So they said, you know, this is not, the method claims cannot be, as a matter of law, cannot be infringed. So that's the takeaway from that, is that, you know, don't just have method claims. Here is another case that I included. It was about software components and in the extraterritorial infringement context. This is also a very famous case from 2007, Microsoft Corp v. AT&T. And even here, actually you'll notice there is some not so great distinctions being made as far as the technology is concerned. This was heavily debated. It was a Supreme Court case. Basically, Microsoft sold Windows to foreign manufacturers, and Windows sent each manufacturer a master version of Windows via disk or electronic transmission. And the foreign manufacturers used the master version to generate copies. And these copies, and not the master version sent by Microsoft, were then installed on the foreign computer manufacturers' computers, and these foreign-made computers were then sold to users abroad. So that's just what happened. Microsoft sent this CD with this disk with a master version, which was copied and then made, put on computers and sold. Computers were sold. So, so here the Supreme Court restricted the scope of 271F, which is assembly abroad, with respect to software components. So they held that because Microsoft did not export from the US the copies of Windows installed on the foreign made computers, Microsoft did not supply from the US components of these computers as required by the statute. So they made a weird distinction between copies of Windows installed on computers, foreign made computers, and what they actually sold. So if they were sending the copies over that were installed, that would have been different. So that was a very, almost a distinction without a difference. And So basically they said software on the Microsoft Master Disk before being copied and installed onto a computer was abstract and therefore did not qualify as a combinable component under 271F. And there was a big dissent here, and also people in the patent community disagreed with this holding for some time. And one of the dissents said that a master disk is actually the functional equivalent of a warehouse of components, and that Microsoft fully expects to be incorporated into foreign manufactured computers. So actually said that Microsoft is going through some loophole here, and this distinction should really have not been made. So the lessons learned from the first trend here is that patent marking 287A requirement does not apply to method claims, as we saw. Plaintiffs that assert only method claims cannot take advantage of the assembly abroad provision. So that's important. Direct infringement may be found of system claims even though parts of the accused system are deployed in another country. This is the NTP holding. Process cannot be used within the US as required by 271A unless each step is performed within the country. Again, part of the NTP holding. And software must be embodied as a combinable component before it is supplied from the US in order to be liable under 271F. So you cannot have abstract software being sent that is not embodied in a as a combinable component, computer readable medium, I guess. Is not a component, so you can combine it abroad and bring it back in, and that would not be infringement. This is the second trend. The second trend here is changes in the standard for joint infringement. So what is joint infringement? Joint infringement is a concept where infringement occurs when multiple parties are responsible for infringing an entire claim, all the steps of the claim. So no one party performs all the steps of the claim, but multiple parties perform the entire claim. So for example, the steps of a method may be performed by one entity, more than one entity. Components may be owned or operated by more than one entity. And so for such claims, there is no liability for joint infringement unless the requisite standard can be shown. And the standard was sort of undecided earlier and was in flux. And then the Federal Circuit, which is a court that decides patent, appellate level court that decides patent issues, they said something about this. This is in this case, BMC Resources, came out in 2007. And here you have the different components at play. You have a debit network, a bank, and a payment system. So so basically this involved methods for processing debit card transactions without the use of PIN numbers. And Payment Tech, which is the defendant here, what it did was it receives payment information like customer account number, amount of the customer's purchase, from a customer at a shop, like a merchant site, like a shop, and forwards this information then to the debit network, which then takes that information and knows which financial institution to forward it to, e.g. bank. And then the bank authenticates the customer, debits the account, and returns the status information, which then gets routed back through the debit network, through Payment Tech system, to the customer. So Payment Tech, essentially what it's doing is getting data from one side and just passing it on. And it really doesn't have any control over what the debit network is doing after it sends it to the debit network. The issue here was for direct infringement under 271A, what is the standard for joint infringement by multiple parties of a single claim? So here everybody agreed that, you know, there were multiple parties involved and that Payment Tech didn't do all the steps, or wasn't involved in each of the steps. So the holding was that one party must nevertheless exercise control or direction over the entire process such that every step is attributable to the controlling party. So you need a mastermind who controls the activities of the other parties. And the court held that there was no evidence that Payment Tech controlled or directed the use of the data that it sent to the debit network. After it sent the data over to the debit network, it didn't care what happened to the data after that. So after that, people in the patent community wondered whether what control or direction meant. Sending data obviously didn't mean control or direction, but that did you know, what would you actually have to do to control another party? Would you have to, you know, give them instructions? What exactly would you have to do? And a year later, there was another case, the mini auction case that came out from the Federal Circuit that sort of expounded on what control or direction meant. And in this case, the asserted patent was directed to, it's basically an auctioning system, online auctioning system for bonds, municipal bonds. And there was no dispute even in this case that a single no single party performed every step of the asserted claims. In fact, you'll see here, this was the system. There's the auctioneer system, then there's the bidders, sort of a client-server system in which, and there's a, they have a method claim here that they asserted. There's an inputting step that the bidders do. They input the data, so they input their bid. And then the auctioneer system takes over and automatically computes some things, submits the bid to another part of the system, communicates at least one message, displays certain aspects. So all the rest of the steps were done by the auctioneer system. The holding in this case was that providing instructions or directions even doesn't constitute control or direction. So the court really told everybody what that was wondering about this, that, you know, even if you give directions, that isn't enough. That Thompson, which is the defendant, controlled access to its system and instructs bidders on its use is not sufficient to incur liability for direct infringement. So they said that was not enough. In fact, their holding also said that mere arm's length cooperation is obviously not enough. Just having an agreement with another party is not enough. But it also stated that there was one situation where the control or direction would definitely be satisfied, and that is vicarious liability, which is a very, very high standard. That is, you know, the other party basically has very little control, very little say, and one of the parties is vicariously liable for everything the other party does. So the thought here is that it's a very high standard. Obviously, it may not be as high as vicarious liability because that was not the only thing that would satisfy control or direction. But the one example the court gave was a pretty high standard. So what are the lessons from the BMC and mini auction line of cases? The lesson is that control or direction is a very tough standard to meet. And so therefore, we have to be sure to structure claims at drafting time to capture infringement by a single party. So the way you could draft a claim and write it in the way that mini auction or BMC wrote it, where a bunch of different steps are performed, and without thinking about who is infringing your patent, you might write it that way because you don't care about who's infringing your patent when you're drafting your claim. Most people don't, but that's wrong because in the end, when you try to assert your claims, you have to actually, and everybody, each step is done by someone else, showing control or direction then becomes really hard, and you're unlikely to find infringement. And the court actually said here that it was not going to unilaterally restructure the claim. So it wasn't going to redraft the claim that was written because it was an ill-conceived claim, and it's on the claim drafter to draft better claims rather than the court to restructure it or to change the standard for joint infringement so that somebody doesn't, so that, you know, because the drafter drafted the claim badly, the owner of the patent doesn't suffer. So that's something to know for joint infringement situations. The third trend I'm going to talk about is overly broad claims that have been resulting in many cases of patent invalidity at trial. So obviously everybody thinks that getting a very broad claim is a good idea, and it's a big win if you can get your argument across and the patent examiner allows you to have a very broad claim. But on the other hand, at litigation, courts are on the lookout for such claims. So what is an overly broad claim? Not just broad claims, a broad claim is a good thing, but an overly broad claim is a claim where the scope of the claims are greater than the scope of enablement. So here you have the scope of the claim, which is the blue circle, so which is fairly large, and then the scope of the disclosure is very small. So you've actually enabled very little of everything you've invented. You've enabled a small portion. So you've not really taught your invention. You've kept certain things secret. That's the feeling, like you've not given to the public what you should have to get a patent. And recently, this was applied. Section 112, paragraph 1, which is enablement, was applied to a lot of electrical and mechanical innovations to invalidate them. And so in the software context, this is very relevant because there are a lot of overly broad software claims. In fact, one of the reasons, one of the arguments made against software patents is that often they are too broad. So there are two principles that are in tension here for overly broad claims within U.S. patent law. I'm not sure if there are parallels in Indian patent law. Maybe you'll be able to tell me that later. But one of them is line of cases that say that we do not import limitations into claims from the specifications, the different embodiments that you have in your written description or specification. So patent has claims, then has specifications, which explain what the patent, what the invention is in layman term, not layman, but like terms that a person of ordinary skill in the art would understand. And so here it says that if you have a bunch of different embodiments, typically you write something like, this is one way that the invention can be practiced, this is another way, and blah, 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 you have a bunch of different ways. If you make that language general enough, you don't say this is the only way or something in your specification, then a court or the patent examiner is not going to import those limitations into your broader claim language and say, well, you must have this one limitation that's in this embodiment. So that's one principle that is a basic principle in U.S. patent law. Another principle is that the scope of the claims must be less than or equal to the scope of enablement. So you have to enable your invention. You have to let the public know what you have actually invented. And so you can't claim broader than something than what you have taught in your patent. And both these basically say that you should enable more. You know, they say that you should put more examples. By enable means, you know, by embodiments I mean examples in the patent about how to work your invention. And so these principles are in tension, and to find the right balance, but you still want a broad patent, but you know, not to. And so you don't get an overly broad patent, you have to sort of balance these two principles, and which is a tough thing to do. And but knowing that the factors that the court looks at is a good way to know whether you've gone overboard and gotten hugely broad claims or not. So one of the factors is, was there only one embodiment? Was there only one example in your claim, in your specification? And courts usually, when they see only one example of how to use your invention, they'll limit your claims to that one embodiment. So you don't want to do that. You want to have many examples. Do you have generic or black box embodiments where you don't really describe anything? You have a bunch of figures with lines through them and you very generally describe what's happening, but you don't actually describe what you have invented. You don't say how to do something. You just say that something is done, and each of your components is a black box. And then the obvious question is, so does your claim meet the written description and enablement requirements? There are a couple of cases I'll talk about in this area that will show you what I mean with all this background. LizardTech versus Earth Resource Mapping involved a method for forming a seamless wavelet transform for image compression. Don't worry if you don't know what that means. No, most courts don't, and you know, I barely do. So basically the thing to know here is that there was a key feature that was maintaining updated sums. So the way the invention was performed in the description of the invention, the specification, everywhere they had this, oh, you have to maintain updated sums, I guess there was only one embodiment, but in that one embodiment and elsewhere in the description, maintaining updated sums was described as something that was really important. And yet, the claim that was written and asserted, claim 21, did not contain this maintaining updated sum requirements. So you can see what they were trying to do. The patentee was trying to assert a claim of something, you know, they only had a method to perform these DWT transforms with using this updated sums technique. But they were trying to claim all methods for, you know, forming a seamless wavelet transforms, even ones that did not have this maintaining updated sums. So they were trying to claim something more than they had invented. So the court said that there is no support for such a broad claim in the specification. The specification provides only a single way of creating a seamless DWT, which is by maintaining updated sums of DWT coefficients. There is no evidence that the specification contemplates a more generic way. So they looked at the specification and said, this inventor really doesn't know how to do this in any other way. So they don't deserve a patent that claims what they didn't invent. So claim 21 was invalid under 112, which is enablement, lack of enablement. So now the second case is Citric versus DreamWorks. And there were a bunch of other cases too. I've just picked these two as exemplary. The background of this case was an invention that was that let you integrate your image into a video game. So basically, when you have a character in a video game, you can upload your image and have your image be put whenever the video, whenever a scene is rendered, your image gets put as that, you show up as that character in the video game. So it was kind of a neat invention. But everywhere in the specification, I guess I'll tell you first that the patentee at trial got a very broad claim construction. They were suing DreamWorks, which is a movie producer. So they were very happy that they had a very broad claim. So they were very happy that they got a claim construction that involved both video games and movies. However, at trial, DreamWorks' expert witness testified that there were some very fundamental technological differences between how video games and movies rendered images of characters. And these differences made it impossible for to use the invented techniques described in this patent to replace pre-existing images, that is character images, with new images, or the user's images in movies. So the way that movies are rendered, pixel by pixel, and the way video games are rendered, where you can actually address different characters and, you know, get those signals before they are rendered and put your own, replace your image. You can follow around characters in a video game and you can't do it in a movie, basically. So, and they hadn't, in their specification, talked about movies. They had said something about, oh, we also cover movies, but they didn't actually disclose how this technique that they described for video games would translate to movies. So the holding here was that there was no disclosure of how inventive technique could be used to replace pre-existing character images in a movie with new images, as I just said. All disclosures were made in the specification with reference to video games. And a patentee who chooses broad claim language must make sure that the broad claims are fully enabled. Because the asserted claims are broad enough to cover both movies and video games, the patents must enable both embodiments. Now, this last sentence is important to understand because, you know, it's pretty strong. It basically says, you know, if you have a very broad claim that encompasses both movies and video games, but you have only enabled one of them, that is not enough. That still makes your claim invalid. You have to have enabled both of them. So you can't hope to fully enable something and not fully enable something else that you also claim by the breadth of your claim, and still hope to be a valid claim. So this patent was invalidated because of that. So the lessons from Lizard Trek and Citrix, from the Citrix line of cases.
So the previous one, the entire patent gets invalidated, or just the part where they talk about enablement with regard to a movie?
Well, your claim that you asserted, you know, if you're asserting just one claim and that claim is invalidated, then essentially you lose the case. Your patent.
But they had an inventive technique that would make it possible for inventors to replace pre-existing character images in video games at least.
Yeah.
They had that inventive technique, mm-hmm. Yes. But they could not explain how it would be done in case of a movie.
Yeah, yeah.
On that basis, the patent got invalidated.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, does that claim also go, which was there with regard to the video games?
No, if they have a narrow claim, which they only covers, yeah, that would be fine still. But, so it's a good idea, this is a good point you bring up, it's a good idea to have a varying breadths of claims in your patents too. It's good to have some broad claims, some narrower claims. The downside is they wouldn't be able to sue DreamWorks with that narrower claim, but that claim would actually still be valid. But this claim, I mean, if they had only these really broad claims that encompassed movies and video games, then, you know, essentially like all their claims would be invalidated, but depends on their claims. And I don't remember whether they had narrower claims or not, but they had asserted this really broad claim. So you invalidate claims in a patent, but then depending on how your patent is, you could get your whole thing.
I have a related question, actually the same question, as in, do they read down your claim, or only, they will do that only if you state your claim in A, B, C, D format, so that if they read down something, they can clearly strike it off?
What do you mean read down?
In the sense that, see, here there was a claim asserted on the patenting of characters of people in the video games. Just characters of people. Now this could have happened in two ways, in video games and movies.
Yeah.
So the court could have said that you can claim a patent for video games.
Yeah.
Because that's what you are enabling any reader to do.
Mm-hmm.
But you are not enabling anything for movies.
Mm-hmm.
So a limited patent could be granted.
Yeah, I mean, then if for instance they had, like I said, if they had another claim that covered, that was a less broad, it was a narrower claim that covered video games only, that would still live. That would be fine, but a broad claim like this would definitely be.
They so after this, they have the opportunity to redraft a narrower claim.
They can't really redraft. There are a lot of issues with redrafting. That's a whole other. You know, you have to reissue a patent. Then you have to show that you met certain.
The
criteria.
Problem with redrafting is once the claim is filed, it would come into the existing knowledge, and then it has already been disclosed. Now, if you try to redraft the claim, then
there are certain ways people do add claims and add disclosure to patents.
Because if the entire claim is rejected, and then they won't have any ability to file another separate narrower claim with regard to that, because that disclosure has already happened.
Yeah, they now can file a continuing application. I mean, trolls often do these things where they like.
So are there like some way out for these people who could actually just claim a narrower patent for with regard to video?
They could if they meet all the criteria for they could get a patent reissued with narrower claims. That they have to meet a lot of different criteria for that. The easiest way is to just draft a patent with a whole lot of different different claim breadths. Like you have broad claims, then you have which are harder to get through the patent office. Then you have narrower claims which the examiner usually lets you get very easily. So it's good to throw in like two or three narrow claims that ensure that your patent isn't totally invalidated, so that you can have something to assert against someone. Because it is kind of hard to reissue a patent or to make sure you have like to file a continuing application. And there are companies that their whole business model is based on filing continuing applications and waiting, and there are trolls. But most companies don't do that. They file a patent, get it, and then assert it. After they get a patent, they assert it, and then if it gets thrown out, I guess they try to assert one of their. They have hundreds of patents, so they try to assert another one. So but it's a good question. Does that answer your question?
Excuse me, I have a question.
Yeah.
Assuming in this case that at the time the video game thing was there, the movies were not a thing that were in life,
mm-hmm.
and during the 20th period, suddenly the movies thing come and these are response that gets stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't the doctrine of equivalence would have come into picture in this?
But even under that, you have to enable the equivalent.
But you don't know how it is enabled.
But that is the whole point, like with enablement. With doctrine of equivalence, it's like if it's a small enough change, then someone should not be. Your patent should cover that. Someone shouldn't be able to get off of infringement by just making a little change to your patent because you've disclosed it. So that's the risk you run. So that's what doctrine of equivalence covers. But this is something else. This is sort of you're claiming something that is not even an equivalent. You had no idea how to do movies, and your technique doesn't cover movies because the expert said that. So fundamentally different, they really couldn't be applied to movies. So,
but in this, if it was.
Yeah, then you could claim a doctrine of equivalence. If it wasn't a fundamental difference like that, if it was just an incremental something, they changed this one thing, and So, the lessons learned from this line of cases is disclose for patentees, if you're the plaintiff. The disclosure, disclose alternative embodiments and build in descriptions of equivalence as you can, wherever you can. getting back to your point with equivalence, include a variety of claims, different types of claims, systems, methods, different breadth of claims, and recite key or essential elements. It's always good to recite essential elements. Often the traditional thinking is that don't recite essential elements, that will just be used to narrow your claims down and defeat infringement, but it's actually a good idea, on the other hand, to reveal a few essential elements, maybe in a few different embodiments, to get over enablement issues. For accused infringers, that is defendants, this is a possible defensive tool when your accused device, if you look at your accused device and look at the disclosed embodiments in the specification, that will give you a clue to whether you can argue a lack of enablement or poor written description. Also, you can consider using the patentee's broad claim construction in re-examination proceedings. Often they get broad claim constructions. Often trolls do this. Then you can use a broad claim construction that the patentee did at trial and ask for a broad claim construction before you then go in and argue enablement and get the court to throw out the claim or the entire patent as it might be. So just some general practice pointers from all of these three different trends that we have identified. Before drafting claims, understand the scope of the invention and the commercial value. So talk to the, communicate with the inventors as much as you can to discuss what the real scope of the invention is. Tendency is to often think that, we'll cover everything we can, but that's not a good idea all the time. Consider all existing and possible infringing activity, whether your invention is going to be infringed by many people, many entities, or one. Often in telecommunication systems, you want to say you want to claim both the the hand. If you want to write an invention that involves both the handheld phone, the handset, as well as the towers, you kind of want to write claims that are directed to each system differently, so that the network, people who control the network and people who control the handheld are different. The manufacturers of the handheld are often different, so you don't want to put them together. You can have one broad claim that has different entities involved, but not always a good idea to do that for all your claims. And identify and gather information on potential infringers or licensees, where they are geographically, for instance. And then draft claims with an eye towards enforcement. Use all available claiming techniques to best leverage applicable facts. A lot of this is general advice, but it's usually not followed. Be mindful of extraterritorial issues, joint infringement problems, and overly broad claims, because these are very issues that the courts are now beating down on. And use all claim types relevant to the technology at issue. Be aware of, often your invention fits very naturally into one of the claim types, like it's a method, it's a process of doing something, or it's a system, very obviously different components interact to perform something, some actions. But try to fit them into different claim types, even though it might sound awkward when you write it out. Now for the rest of the time, I'll talk about the Bilski case at the US Supreme Court. Shamnath mentioned that you would be interested in hearing about this, because it'll be out any day now, and it affects how business methods, for sure, and software by extension, software patents by extension, are viewed, whether they're going to be allowed at all or not. So the overarching issue in this case is, should business methods be patentable? And I forgot to mention that, I guess I must have mentioned that the firm I work for represented Bilski in this case, which is the patentee with the business method claim. I didn't really actually work on the case, I wasn't lucky enough. But I did a little bit of case law research, which was like 0.2 hours or something, so it wasn't great. Should business methods be patentable? If business methods are not patentable, how does such a result affect software patents? And I put that in quotes because, software patents involves, software per se, then software that involves some hardware, etc. So Software in the abstract may be thought of as simply a series of instructions to a machine for the processing of information. So in a lot of ways, business methods and software are very similar. And so the Bilski decision will affect software patents, although it's not directly about software patents. It has a lot of influence. And of course, this is all in the US context. I'll give you a quick background of the case, and then I'll tell you what the question presented was, the specific question. then key issues that were presented in the briefs, as well as, you know, that came up at oral arguments. The key precedent that the Supreme Court is going to look at to decide this case. A whole discussion that ensued during oral arguments about useful arts and technological arts. And just a small...